Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name's Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin in Stephanie's office, high above the Rideau River, which, Stephanie, I am pleased to announce for our earnest listeners, has a series of small ice flows. It looks like it's freezing. They are, in fact, preparing the canal for skating once again, now that it's become brisk. We need some fresh snow, though. It's a bit icy for the skiing and the regular classic
skiing.
We need none of this. We may get some more rain, unfortunately.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So what are we doing today?
Well, okay, so last week we ended with a whole pile on cyber threats, and we kind of looked at the cyber espionage and foreign influence side. And then, right as we were recording, there was a flurry of reports on violent extremism and terrorism that were released. I'm told that actually some people were calling it Terrorism Tuesday in government. I think there was like about three or four different things that were released. I actually want to revisit the CSIS director's speech and see what he said on violent extremism, because there were some important comments there. There's that report that we talk about every year, and we did talk about last year, the public report on the terrorism threat. There was then a new Countering Radicalization to Violence, or CRV, report that was put out. And then there was a FinTrack report as well. And what's going to be great about that is I actually got to interview one of our former guests, Jess Davis, who was on episode 45 about what all that report meant and the kind of implications of it. And then I believe there was also a 45-day report.
Yes.
Which was the response to the conservative question about foreign fighters and what the government's doing.
Right. And Minister Goodale then gave a speech on the Friday, last Friday. We're recording this on Tuesday. And he gave a speech on Friday. So just some acronyms here. So CRV, Countering Radicalization to Violence, that's from the Canada Centre for Community Engagement and Prevention of Violence, which hereafter will be called the Canada Centre.
I think they call themselves the Canada Centre because a CCCEPV is not maybe as catchy as they thought it was.
And we, of course, had Ritu Banerjee come and speak to us as one of our Intrepid podcasts back last year about their work. This seems to be a bit of a capstone summarizing much of the work they have been doing. So we'll talk about that. And then you mentioned this 45-day report. This was the report that was tabled in Parliament in response to the opposition motion asking for the government to provide a policy on foreign fighter returnees. And I think you have to read that 45-day report together with the annual terrorism threat report, in part because there's a lot of overlap, but there are some small differences I thought were quite interesting.
I hope you appreciate this, Intrepid podcast listeners. I spent like literally my entire Sunday just going through this smorgasbord of reports. I mean, they say ask and ye shall receive, and holy cow. Because, you know, I've been a pretty big advocate for more transparency, more reports, more discussion out there. And now I'm reaping what I sowed. And I'm spending Sundays in December not watching schmaltzy Hallmark Christmas films. I'm going through terrorism reports. So either way, it's a bad life
choice. Before we get to the substance here, bear with us, listeners, because, you know, it's near the holiday season and we're a bit frivolous. But in terms of holiday viewing, beyond watching Die Hard, which everyone has to watch, of course, for Christmas purposes.
There's
the fourth season of Le Bureau des Légendes, the Bureau in English, which is about the French Foreign Intelligence Service.
Right.
Which is by far the best intelligence show I've ever seen. Anyway, the fourth season is now available on iTunes. That's my wife and I have scheduled some good quality watching of Le Bureau during the holiday season.
I'm going to stick to my Hallmark. But just getting back to the report, because having read this all together, I would say that, you know, there's clearly some coordination here, but there's clearly some areas for improvement. There's a lot of terms that aren't consistent. So, for example, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is the new name for Jabhat al-Nusra or al-Nusra Front, they're described differently. Some places they call them Tahrir al-Sham. Like, so there's not a consistent use of names. I felt that the public report said more on terrorism financing than the FinTrack report, and that the FinTrack report said more about foreign fighters than the public threat report. So I think it is important for, you know, if this is something that you are paying attention to or you're studying in this area, do read all these reports together, because you're not going to get the full picture from reading just one of them. Again, I wanted to maybe start with the director's speech. Okay. Yeah. He says, we're also aiming to be more transparent about our work by engaging with Canadians about the threats we're facing. We hope to make them our partners in building them in protections against these threats. So it's interesting in that there's a lot, again, there was a lot in that speech. If you haven't read it, that's probably the one out of all of this is probably the easiest to read and possibly the most important, I think. But a lot of this stuff is again, trying to explain what the threats to Canadians are. He talks about the fact that Canadians have lost their lives in Burkina Faso, Indonesia, Jordan, Kenya, Spain, and the UK in the last 5 years. So, you know, it's not just about the terrorist threat at home. It's very important we work with our allies because Canadians are affected by terrorism globally. Unsurprisingly, all the reports basically say that the main terrorist organization is, they call it Daesh. I don't like saying that word because I sound terrible, so I will refer to it as the Islamic State. And it's his portrayal of it, and I think this is consistent across the different reports, is that it's no longer a fighting force, but it's one that still has the power to radicalize. There is also another theme here that, again, is throughout all the reports, which is the kind of turn to low sophisticated attacks that are against either crowds or police officers that are a lot harder to prevent because they really just require a vehicle. The risk of more sophisticated attack remains. And that's something that I think CSIS has to grapple with, which is, you know, what's more important, the kind of lone actor, more probable attacks, or a more serious attack that's well coordinated based on individuals who go overseas, get that training, and then can kind of execute a Paris style attack. So that's something that you're always trying to balance out.
Low probability, high consequence. High probability, low consequence.
Yeah, exactly. And how do you measure the risk, or how do you prioritize that in terms of your investigations, but also in the way you communicate the threat, right? So all that's important. So the one other thing that's in the director's speech that I think is consistent across the reports, with the exception of FinTrack, is the emphasis on the complex spectrum of individuals that he talks about. He says, you know, he talks about it's not just Islamist extremism, but basically there's many different types of groups that are cultivating what he calls real or perceived grievances on issues as varied as gender, race, religion, sexual orientation, and immigration. And it's interesting, the sexual orientation, because that's clearly a reference to Alex Manassian and the Toronto attack as well. So it's kind of funny that the report dances around whether or not that was actually a terrorist attack. I mean, in the language of the report, it's a violent extremism one. We've talked about this before a lot, actually. We had that amazing episode where we fought about what is a terrorist attack and what isn't. And it's interesting that the director is speaking about this in the same breath.
Yeah, and that also comes up in the actual terrorism report as well.
Yes.
Where they're much more emphatic in pooling the Toronto event into the discussion about terrorism, but also hold back a little bit.
So speaking of the public report, though, maybe we should dive right into it. What was your impression?
Well, so I went back and I listened to episode 18 from our podcast. And so we did that back in early January. And recall that there we focused on the terrorism report from 2017. When you first read it, you gave it a B-. Right? So we did our grading thing. We had just finished marking piles and piles of papers. You started with a B-. You moved up to a B because, as I recall, you were more cheery in January than you were in December. And last year's, I probably would have given a C, which is below average by law school standards. I think I'm going to give them a B this year, Stephanie. I want to suggest that there's room for improvement, but there has been a change from last year.
I'm kind of tempted to give them a B+, but I'm wavering simply because of the way the Sikh issue was handled. I would say there is an improvement.
So last year, well, my principal concern was the absence of data points. It was entirely qualitative. It was this qualitative, almost brochure-style discussion. There's no quantitative indicators. This year there is, all right? So there's more quantitative information, although it is fairly rudimentary. So the one data point that really comes out in this year's report, they pulled information on prosecutions. So 55 prosecutions or 55 individuals who have been charged since 9/11 under terrorism offenses.
Is that consistent with your numbers?
That's consistent, right? So Michael Nesbitt's out at University of Calgary is the one who's been tracking these data. I'm pretty sure those are consistent with his numbers. Michael, you can tweet me and tell me what your numbers say. But they're consistent with my latest tracking data, which is now a couple years out of date. So that number doesn't surprise me. It's also numbers that you can compile yourself laboriously through press releases from the RCMP, from court records, from plans and priorities documents from the Public Prosecution Service of Canada, etc. Where I have some other issues. So the other two aspects of this report that I thought were interesting was, first, there's more definition and there's more focus on things other than Islamist inspired terrorism. So those are two other qualities that were an issue for us last year. So on more definition, recall last year, there's been a propensity in the way we describe in these reports what we're talking about, terrorist related activities, which I never really understood what that meant. At one point last year, they started talking about terrorist activities, which is actually a legally understood term. And I thought, oh, great, now I know what they're talking about, before they reverted again to referring to terrorist-related activities. So there was some murkiness in the definition. This time around, they seem to have abandoned these terms which have a legal imprimatur in the criminal code, and they're talking now about extremism. And they have a definition of extremism, which I thought was very useful. So at very least, if you're not going to use terms that are derived from the criminal code, tell us what you mean. And so the definition here, and here's a reference, Canadian extremist traveler, an individual with a Canadian nexus who has traveled abroad to participate in extremist activity. And then they define extremist activity. Extremist activity is defined as any activity undertaken on behalf of or in support of a terrorist entity. It can include, but is not limited to, participation in armed combat, financing, radicalizing, recruiting, media production, and other activity. Now, that's probably a broader orbit of activity than might be encompassed by our criminal law. Now, in the right circumstance, all of those things could be participation with a terrorist group, but not necessarily. So they're using a concept of extremism that is broader than perhaps sort of a narrow, a myopic legal understanding. And that's fine, so long as we understand what they're talking about.
No, I would agree with that. Not everything that public safety does, obviously, is aimed towards necessarily prosecution. They do have a broader mandate than what is just in the law. And I agree with you. If you define your terms, it's part of your way of winning the debate. So good on them for doing so.
Now, this is what's tied to another data point. So recall that one of the debates last year, continuing into this year, is how many of these Canadian extremist travelers have returned to Canada. This report suggests the numbers are static. Notwithstanding they changed the definition a bit, the number is static relative to last year. And so, I think it's important to spell out what they're talking about here. 190 individuals, that is extremist travelers with a nexus to Canada, are currently abroad. Approximately half who are abroad are located in Turkey, Syria, or Iraq. Approximately 60 additional individuals with a nexus to Canada who are suspected of engaging in extremist activities abroad have returned to Canada. Of these 60, only a relatively small number of those who have returned are from Turkey, Iraq, or Syria. All right, so 60 returnees, only a relatively small number of which are from Islamic State and the regions associated with it. Relatively small is not a quantitative measure, but I think if you're going to use relatively small, it's got to be a minority.
I think, well, according to Amar Singham, who's a friend of ours, but also probably Canada's best researcher on this, he pegged it at the low teens.
Yeah.
Right? So it's in the low teens.
So I'm going to continue with my assertion from last year. We're probably talking about less than 30.
Oh, certainly.
Less than 20. The one data point that's missing here, last year they said, but a majority of those who have returned from these territories, that is Turkey, Iraq, and Syria, have engaged in combat. That's not here anymore. So that reference to the majority of the minority, the majority of the persons who have been returnees from these war zones in Iraq, Syria, and Turkey being persons who participate in combat, that's gone from here. So I don't know whether there's been a change in the understanding or whether it's just an omission associated with the editing process.
I would suspect it's the latter. It seems to me that those numbers haven't changed very much. It's interesting to see that particular number. We don't publicly know that much about how it's calculated. The one thing that I picked up on the foreign fighter side, and this gets into the FinTrack report we'll talk about later, what's really interesting is, again, there wasn't a consistent message across the reports. It's interesting because the public report, the other ones, they basically say, look, there's not a lot of these guys coming back. Why? Because, frankly, they're dead. There may be some belief that they are, in fact, scared of being arrested or just want to hang out over.
Well, they can't come back because there's all sorts of restrictions on travel.
Right. Also that. But the FinTrack report actually talks about how a number of fighters could return to Canada. And I thought that was interesting, was that they were a little off message with regards to the rest of the reports. I think they kind of made it sound a little bit worse than what the other reports were saying. And I thought that was a little bit bizarre.
Yeah. Now, a couple other areas where I think there's room for improvement. So recall last year that I said there's all other data points that could be pulled in for quantitative purposes. So, for instance, the number of law enforcement justifications where the police, in this case, we'll be talking about the RCMP, can get authorization to otherwise breach the law in the course of conducting investigations, say as an undercover. Those data are supposed to be public. Now, I checked this morning. Incidentally, the latest data we have are from 2016. They have not yet released, as best I can tell, the 2017 data. And that seems to be behind the usual sort of release dates that we've had in the past. Usually the data from the prior calendar year or fiscal year is released in the summer. So I'm not sure where that report is. But as of 2016, there was no law enforcement justification for terrorism investigations, suggesting that the pace and cadence had fallen off. So too, Part 6 wiretap warrants, which we talk about from time to time, the number of warrants issued for 2016 had fallen off significantly for terrorism investigations. Again, the 2017 report isn't up yet. So these are data that's supposed to be public. It'd be interesting to incorporate all these into the terrorism report so we have a better sense, again, of operational tempo or cadence. The one indication we have that Tampa was falling off, no charges, terrorism charges from 2018. That's in the report. So that suggests there's been a change, say, from the frenetic activity we saw in the aftermath of 2014. And then with the rise of ISIS, now, notwithstanding, of course, ISIS continues to pose a problem. It's a different sort of problem than we would have seen, say, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, it's less about travel, more about attacking a place. But even then, yeah, I think you're right that information about warrants and things like that would definitely help give us a better picture as to what's happening.
So too, threat activity analyses that come out of CERC. For instance, we know how many investigations or targets CSIS engages in because that's information that's in the CERC report, albeit tied to the broad concept of threats to security Canada, not limited to terrorism. But again, those sort of data are useful. It's really, the bottom line is I'm updating now my national security law textbook. I'm finding that the data reporting, as in numbers, quantitative numbers, have fallen actually since the last edition. And that's true not just for the services. That's also true for CERC. CERC used to report, the Security Intelligence Review Committee, which reviews CSIS, used to report a lot of hard data. And that's not there anymore and hasn't been for a number of years. And I find that in updating the data that I'm obliged either to rely on data that's more than a decade old, or I'm filing a lot of ATIPs for data that once upon a time I could get at a glance from annual reports.
So there's a couple of issues that I picked up on in this report that were interesting. One was interesting. It was the return of the term Sunni Islamist extremism. That was not used in last year's reports. When I was working in this area, let me tell you, the government was really tying itself in knots as to what to refer to Sunni Islamist extremism as. Like, is it Al-Qaeda? We used, you know, sometimes we used Al-Qaeda, Islamic State-inspired extremism as kind of a euphemism, but then that's not all the kinds of extremism out there. There's many different kinds of movements. It's been a huge issue. The Liberal government kind of tried to push a movement towards Daesh. The word Sunni doesn't even appear in the 2017 public report. So it was interesting to see that particular return. What's interesting is that I think there is this attempt to broaden. To me, it's the first time ever the government has actually tried to broaden the understanding of the kinds of violent extremism out there. Certainly, it's the most diverse public report we've seen since these reports started coming out. But the problem is it wasn't executed as well as I think it could have been. And the big issue that's come out of this, and the one thing Ralph Goodale has come under a lot of criticism for, is the way that Sikh extremism is talked about in this report. And let's just start off by saying, we talked about the AWOL report a couple podcasts ago. It is clear that there are ongoing Sikh investigations in Canada, Sikh extremism investigations, right? That it's a small investigation. They are low priority. They are not a main source of threats to Canada. And the reason we know that is no other government report has talked about Sikh extremism in a very long time. And I actually went back and I went through as many public reports that CSIS has put out.
I did the same.
Right. I could go as far back as 2004. That's a whole other issue why the other reports
aren't
online.
I didn't go back that far.
But I looked every year. Sikh extremism does not appear in a single report. And so, you know, I think the Sikh community in Canada feels really blindsided by this. There has been ongoing investigations into Sikh extremism since the 1980s. They continue to exist today. But if you just kind of drop this paragraph out of nowhere with no context whatsoever and only refer to an incident that occurred in the 1980s, that is not really, I think, sufficient for the purposes of this report. The other major concern I have with the way that this was discussed is that Sikh extremism is talked about in the same breath as the Islamic State. And that is factually inaccurate, right? There's actually a heading. It says Sunni Islamist extremism. And there's a whole discussion about Sikh extremism right underneath that. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Why was that done? These are, you know, Sikh extremism exists. It's a lie to pretend it doesn't exist in Canada. But to talk about it in the same way as you would talk about the threat of something like the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda is just wrong. It's totally different. And this really wasn't handled well. I don't think the government can lie about not having Sikh extremist investigations, because it clearly does. But I think this really could have been introduced better. And this is really unfortunate, because I really welcome an attempt to diversify our understanding of what terrorism and violent extremism looks like in Canada, because it's not just Sunni Islamist extremism. There's many different types of violent extremism, and it's going to evolve again. Like, who knows what it's going to be? It's good to basically paint this picture, but you have to be so careful with the way that you handle this. It doesn't surprise me that they're angry about it. And I did have some discussions about it on Twitter with some of the people who are kind of leading the charge with regards to how these kinds of issues are discussed. And they are upset, and I understand where they're coming from. I don't think the government should lie, but I actually think part of the problem is the fact that this has never been discussed previously. I mean, we have failed in this country to really kind of talk about the diverse nature of extremist threats in Canada. And now when you suddenly try and do it in this kind of relatively ham-fisted way, that's going to upset people, and it did.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction. The issue has reemerged in the public space because of L'Affaire Etoile, which, as you mentioned, we talked about a few weeks ago. Now, in that NISICOP report, the actual substantive discussions of, you know, Sikh, what we'll call here for the purposes of consistency, Sikh extremism, it's all redacted, right? We don't know what was before NISICOP, what they looked at.
Right.
The first substantive assessment we have is in this one paragraph dropped into this report. I have to wonder why it was dropped into this report. Was this resuscitated as a preoccupation because of the L'Affaire Etoile, and therefore it would have seemed incongruent to have it raised in the L'Affaire Etoile and not then raised in this report? And I agree with you that the discussion here, there is an element of apples and oranges. The discussion that precedes it about the Al-Qaeda or ISIS-inspired threat, which is a term I tend to use to describe Islamist terrorism, Al-Qaeda or ISIS-inspired, and I appreciate that that's just a choice. I do depart from that from time to time.
There's no happy way to do
this. There's no happy way to do it, right? But the actual discussion of the Sikh extremism, so heading, Sikh extremism, essentially says, while attacks around the world in support of the movement have declined, support for extreme ideologies of such groups remains. Support, okay. Support for extreme ideologies. As we learn from reading the report from the Canada Centre, you can have extreme views. That's not the issue. The issue is the mobilization thereafter to violence. Okay, so I would like to know a little bit more about the violent aspect of this in a report on terrorism. And then it says that two key Sikh organizations have been identified as being associated with terrorism and remain listed terrorist entities under the criminal code. Well, that's fine, except there's a whole bunch of other entities that are listed as terrorist entities in the criminal code, like the LTTE, like the FARC, like others, who are not mentioned anywhere in this report. Yeah. So the fact of being listed is not itself an indicator of threat, necessarily.
No.
And so I would, again, like a tie back to the focus of this report, which is about the terrorism threat to Canada. And I don't think this paragraph does it. And so I understand the concern.
Yeah.
One other area where I think we have made progress in terms of broadening the reach, though, of this discussion of extremism is the right-wing aspect.
Right, yeah.
So you recall that last time when we discussed the 2017 report, that was in the immediate aftermath of the shooting at Quebec Mosque and received barely any notice or mention in the 2017 report. Here, there's a fairly substantial discussion of right-wing extremism, albeit with some caveats, right? And so there's a discussion here of the Toronto events, the van attack in Toronto, which I thought was kind of interesting in the sense that it's right there in the executive summary near the beginning. The April 2018 van attack in Toronto is a reminder that violent acts driven by extremists' views are not exclusively linked to any particular religious, political, or cultural ideology. So right away, I get worried about cultural ideology. What does that mean, first of all? It's not actually in the definition of terrorist activity in the criminal code. It harkens back to one of the objections that many of us had to Minister McKay a few years ago, discussing the plot to shoot up in Halifax a shopping center associated with sort of a Columbine neo-Nazi viewpoint that it wasn't terrorism because it wasn't culturally tied, that this was a subtext for essentially that terrorism is only for Islamists. I don't like the word cultural. It comes from nowhere. And so I think we should avoid using it. The actual term is terrorist activity is motivated by religion, politics, or ideology. Then in discussing the van attack at some other point in the report, they say it may be difficult to assess in the short term to what extent a specific attack was ideologically driven or comment while investigations are ongoing or cases are before the court. So there's a little bit of a caveat there, like, it'd be incongruent for us not to talk about it given its notoriety, but we're really not going to call it as being, in this case, terrorism yet, which probably is wise. What was your response to the discussion of right-wing stuff?
So I agree with you. I mean, it's great that they're talking about it in a more lengthy way. I do note they don't actually name any groups, probably because it's hard to do that. But there's a really odd line in the report, and it says, quote, however, while racism, bigotry, and misogyny may undermine the fabric of Canadian society, ultimately they do not result in criminal behavior or threats to national security. Threats to national security we've talked about, but criminal behavior? excuse me, I'm looking at like all of the huge rise in hate crimes, the huge rise in vandalism that we've seen in Canada. These groups tend to engage in what's often called berserker violence, like the kind of engaging in fights and you know, maybe going out and wanting to destroy things. And actually, this line itself is contradicted in the National Strategy on Countering Radicalization of Violence, where they give a scenario of an individual who becomes radicalized to the far right and then engages in criminal activity. That line to me is just absolutely bizarre. It doesn't make any sense in the context of what we're seeing in terms of evidence, in terms of other stuff. It's a really bizarre line.
Just as a possible counterpoint on that. So recall that one of the tensions, and we've had this conversation back and forth when the director was here at the podcast, he raised this. It's raised either in this report or in the 45-day report, which we'll get to in a second. But the issue is drawing the line between antisocial behavior and free expression, which may be antisocial, but it's guarded by the charter, and then conduct that crosses the line, threats of violence, et cetera, which is neither protected by the charter and also is often criminalized. That's a line that they're trying to skate in their discussions, and frankly, all the discussions of right-wing extremism I've seen, try not to conflate odious views with odious behavior, that is criminal behavior. That's not a line that they skate quite as carefully, it seems to me, in relation to other forms of extremism.
But even just the rise in hate crimes and graffiti we've seen, those are crimes.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I
don't think they're denying that. You can have odious views and not be a criminal.
Yes.
And so that's, I think, the point that they're trying to draw out. I agree with you in this context. It probably required a little bit of amplification and perhaps a little bit more sentence structure padding around it.
I just think it's wrong.
But I think that they're probably trying to convey the idea that merely being a bigot does not mean you're a criminal.
Yeah, I think that's good. But that's actually...
And most bigots are not criminals.
No, that's not what they're saying at all. It says, ultimately, they do not usually result in criminal behavior.
Right.
That's not saying...
So most racism, bigotry, or misogyny does not ultimately, in the usual case, result in criminal behavior.
Right. I mean, that's wrong.
No, I think that's true.
I
think
disagree.
I think the proportion of bigots, misogynists, and racists is much greater than the proportion who engage in criminals. I think that a minority will, much as we talk about extremist viewpoints...
But that's
viewpoints,
true of all extremists.
Well, exactly. That's exactly my point. Right. So why draw out this point about people having odious views, not making then the transition to actual criminal conduct in the context of right-wing extremism, while not raising the same sorts of issues in relation to other forms of extremism?
I just think it's hard to deny the fact that we've seen a rise of far-right extremism in Canada. And we've also seen a rise of hate crimes and graffiti. And this line seems to undercut that. Anyway, I mean, either whatever they intended, it comes out bad.
Yeah, I agree. I think that probably what you do is you pull out the discussion about the as they do, frankly, in the CRV report from the center. They pull out the idea that radical views are not the issue. It's radicalization
to
violence.
It's the mobilization.
Irrespective
absolutely.
Of ideology.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, there is a mention of the charter and the right to protest and freedom of conscience and expression at the outset of the report under Sunni Islamist extremism. However, that issue is not really revisited specifically in relation to various brands or ideological brands of extremism, except when you get then to right-wing extremism. So I think it might be better if they were to pull out the discussion of the right to protest and situate it as a separate consideration for all brands of extremism and not sort of reemphasize it for one and not for others. Now, that's nitpicky, I appreciate, but this is a really sensitive issue.
One of the things that was interesting, though, in this front is the first time I've seen an explicit link of the 2014 Moncton shootings to far-right extremism. I've never seen that publicly
made by
the government.
All over the court record, right? It was so classically apparent that that was a case where the person had this...
anti-government ideology,
So this militia-driven, anti-authoritarian preoccupation that was all over the record. There was a serious consideration about whether to lay terrorism charges in that case. This was one of these cases, by the way, that it was... what we keep calling this podcast, right of bang, right? It's after the acts of violence. There was no advantage. The guy was up for multiple counts of murder and attempted murder. There was no advantage to layering on terrorism charges. And so they didn't seek terrorism charges because it's more for the prosecutor to prove, which is also something they talk about in this report and also the 45-day report, which we can get to in a second. And so it was never actually charged and prosecuted to terrorism, but it was graphically apparent if you read the trial records that this guy had an animus that was ideological, directed at the state and agents of the state, in that case, the police.
So I think that was one of the good things about the discussion of far-right extremism. The last thing I would note, though, is that in this report, it's supposed to then talk about the rest of the world and talks about Europe, Asia, and Africa. It only talks about Al-Qaeda and Islamic State-inspired extremism. There is nothing on the far-right in Europe.
Right.
Which is, I think...
Or the United States.
Or the United States, which I think is a bit of a miss, because if what we're seeing now is, I think, a transnational nationalist movement, which is a contradiction in terms, but actually probably what we're seeing. The only other things I would highlight maybe is in the section on Canada's approach to countering terrorism, they talk a lot about managing extremist travelers. There's also an interesting discussion of the National Security Joint Operations Center for the RCMP, something we don't hear a lot about. So there's not that much that's actually publicly known about
that. And it's not really well described. It's high level in this report, as it is in the 45-day report. But I give them credit for talking about it, because frankly, before that, if you wanted to learn about them, you were relying on ATIP.
And I think there's been like two or three media reports on the center. There was actually a fairly detailed explanation of terrorism financing, possibly better than what's in the actual FinTrack report, as at least relates to terrorism financing within Canada.
All right. So we talk about the 45-day report.
Yeah.
So in the October 23rd, the House of Commons adopted a motion from the opposition calling on the government of Canada to immediately bring to justice anyone who has fought as an ISIS terrorist or participated in any terrorist activity, including those who are in Canada or of Canadian citizenship. The problem, of course, was that the call upon the government to immediately bring someone to justice raises all sorts of issues around police and prosecutorial independence. And so the government can't dictate to the police and the prosecutor, you go out and arrest someone. You can't do that, right? That's like, if you listen to Solomon Freeman's podcast on foreign fighters and prosecutions of foreign fighters, that's like gravy for defense lawyers. So what the government did do, though, is respond with a policy statement on foreign fighters, which reflects and amplifies some of the stuff that we've just discussed in the terrorism annual report. And there are a couple of things that are a little bit different here, though. And so one of the things that comes out in this conversation, foreign fighters still abroad, the government is aware of some Canadian citizens currently detained in Syria. There is no legal obligation to facilitate their return. This is a conversation we had in the wake of Stuart Bell's reporting on the persons believed to be affiliated with ISIS who are detained by the Kurds in Syria. And then there's a footnote that goes on to say how under Charter Section 6, there's a mobility right, you have a right to return to Canada, but that doesn't mean the government has to facilitate that return. The wrinkle here might well be, and this is where I think someone like Paul Champ might object,
who's
representing at least one of the individuals who's currently detained by the Kurds. Jack, that's, as I understand it, I may be wrong, sorry Paul if that's not true, he would say that if the government of Canada is the only barrier to return, and so the Kurds are saying, we will release on condition, Canada, you take them back, and Canada is saying, no, we're not prepared to make that commitment. The wall of the prison at that point is Canada. And so there, I think the conversation about the charter mobility rights is very, very different if Canada is de facto the barrier. I don't know if the evidence supports that at present, so it's not an absolute that government of Canada doesn't have to facilitate return. I think the government of Canada can't stand in the way of return. What's at issue with the Kurds issue is remains to be determined, and I suspect it will be eventually at some place in some court at some time.
My only concern with that is that I think a mature country should take care of its own problems. If there are Canadians who are overseas and we're dumping them on other populations, I don't actually think that's a smart counterterrorism policy. I think you're better off developing the institutions and infrastructures you need to actually prosecute these people at home. And so, you know, I do think we should bring them back, and I think we should prosecute them. I think that's the ideal. The idea that, well, we can just leave them there is, to me, it's not only a cop-out, but if other countries were doing the same, we're not happy about that.
Well, I mean, so this is a longer conversation. I agree with you that there's a distinction between the legal obligations of the government and what the government should be doing in these cases. And so I agree with you that the gold standard here should be prosecution. Everyone acknowledges, as these reports suggest, that evidence is going to be a problem. And here the evidence isn't just the classic CSIS doesn't want to share CSIS information with RCMP because CSIS sources will be potentially at issue in full disclosure rules. But there's also the prospect of foreign intelligence being in play here. And there the foreign intelligence will be subject to all sorts of caveats. And we've talked about the third party and originator control three podcasts ago. That's going to be a problem. There's also going to be a problem with the quality of evidence here. If you find some banged up hard drive in some former ISIS post in Syria and it's got a list of membership and it was picked up by a special forces unit and transferred to some other special forces unit, and then it comes through this indirect path to prosecutorial authorities
via a journalist
right? So there's a whole chain of custody and credibility issue for evidence. So in that theater, the evidentiary issues are very, very complex. And so I fully expect that it'll be very difficult in many instances to bring prosecutions. There is, however, a number of other tools, peace bonds and other tools, although, again, you still need information, need evidence for that. And these reports do, I think, do a fairly good job of laying out a menu of the options available to the government in response to returnees and others. One other thing, though, I just want to mention, because I know we're running out of time here, that is new in this report is the discussion of the communications security establishment and what the government imagines the CAC might be doing using its active cyber, which is that issue in C-59, in the foreign fighter space. The new authority would allow CSC to interact with foreign targets operating on computer networks and systems that could be used, for example, to uncover foreign extremist efforts to radicalize individuals to conduct attacks in Canada and abroad. The Act would also give CSC the authority to conduct active cyber operations and allow CSC to use online capabilities to interfere with the ability of foreign terrorist groups to recruit Canadians or plan attacks against Canada and its allies. That's the closest to a concrete assessment of what tactically CSC might be doing in the terrorism space with its new C-59 mandates that I've seen so far.
Okay. So then should we talk about the report on countering radicalization and violence?
Sure, very quickly. I think we're running out of time here.
Sure. So a couple of things. First, this is the first major policy publication of the Canada Centre. I think that's worth noting. The report actually took the opportunity upon its debut to really explain what the threat of radicalization of violence actually is, but also the government's current understanding of it, which is really based on research dating back to the Kanishka Project. I think that's significant. And it talks about how that process of radicalization is diverse, but we often see a few combination of factors like social networks, grievances, vulnerabilities, a desire to belong to something, and an inclination towards violence. But then it also talks about like what protective factors there are out there, such as, positive influences, credible friends, mentors, having a belief system that rejects violence, if people have a sense of purpose, they're less likely to turn to extremist movements. And it also talks about the gender aspect of this, that women often go through the same processes as men, but often experience all these kinds of different factors that radicalize, but also the protective factors, they're experienced differently. They talk then about their approach, which is kind of early prevention and trying to raise awareness and supporting narratives that challenge violent extremism. Then they talk about at-risk extremism. So this is where someone may be in the initial stages of radicalization and the need to support families who are kind of going through this. And then there's policies that are trying to get people to disengage from violence as well. And I think it's really important to break those three things down because there's really been a conflation. Every time you see someone criticizing or countering radicalization of violence programs, they say, oh, we're teaching ISIS poetry. How great. And there, a lot of sarcasm there. But really what you're trying to deal with in the early prevention stages is to help people deal with their anger, to deal with their sense of injustice. And yeah, that's actually maybe where poetry and art comes into it. We're not taking hardened ISIS fighters and teaching them poetry. That's not what's happening here. So they're pretty careful at breaking it all down. And then they also talk about three priorities, the first being research, which TSAS, which we're both members of, I think we're actually both in the executive now, as well as other international networks and partners. It talks a lot about an online countering radicalization of violence strategy. There's actually not a lot here. It talks a lot about free speech and the need to protect people online and digital literacy and the importance of alternative narratives. But again, there's just not a lot in the online space. They talk about the need to engage with tech companies, and their aim is to try and get extremist content taken down within an hour, which, again, I think has been relatively successful on the Islamist extremist side, but is certainly not successful on the neo-Nazi side at all, because you just have to go on YouTube and watch three videos before a Nazi comes up. And then finally, there's talk about supporting interventions, trying to train frontline workers so that, they can either recognize the problems when they start seeing them, but also to raise the issue. In one of the cases that, they talked about, the case of this individual who we talked about when we're talking about the public report, there's this case study they put up of someone who starts radicalizing to the far right. And they say, well, if the teacher had known about had been trained, or if the teacher maybe had access to resources or things like that, then maybe something could have been done before this individual kind of had engaged in crime. The one thing that's missing from this report is that we don't yet know how well these programs are doing. And they talk about a need to develop evaluation tools in it, but we don't really know how good they are, how many people are in them. We don't have, you talked about the lack of data in the public report. Well, there's no data here at all. So there's a discussion on the importance of metrics, but we don't see it here. And I think that is probably one of the biggest gaps we currently have in our knowledge. But you want to understand the kind of way government understands this problem. This is the report to read. It's very good. It's interesting, and it was a good report, and it probably one of the stronger ones out of all of them that came out.
Great. So we have one last thing to do, and this was an interview that you had yesterday discussing another report. This is the report that came out from the Financial Transactions and Report Analysis Center of Canada, FINTRAC, right? These names are terrible. FINTRAC is the acronym, and so heretofore known as FINTRAC. And you sat down and you had a conversation with a podcast alum. What episode?
It's episode 45. We called Showed Me the Money. So it's with Jess Davis, who I actually used to work with, but is also a terrorism financing expert. So it was a good opportunity to kind of work through what this all means.
Okay, so let's listen to that.
So Jess, thank you so much for coming on the podcast to walk us through this new FINTRAC report. As far as I'm aware, it's the first report, and this is going to be really useful because you speak money and I don't. And so I'm wondering, like, you know, what do you make of this report?
Yeah, this is a huge step forward for FINTRAC. So FINTRAC has put out an annual report telling us about the number of disclosures that they've made to law enforcement and security services since its inception, really. But this is the first time that FINTRAC has released what I would call a really substantive report in terms of what terrorist financing looks like in Canada. Now, the center has put out some trends and typologies papers in the past as well, but this is like really leaps and bounds beyond what they've ever done before. And the interesting thing about this is very much targeted towards reporting entities in Canada. So it's basically guidance for them in terms of how they can better improve their reporting to FINTRAC, how they can assess jurisdictions of concern, how they can identify risks that they may be facing in certain jurisdictions.
What do they mean by jurisdiction?
So what they mean by jurisdiction is country.
Okay.
I'm not exactly clear on why they say jurisdiction either, although it's common in the terrorist financing literature. So
okay,
it may just be a bit of a holdover from that. This report is very much for reporting entities, and specifically the way I read it is for money services businesses and banks in Canada. There might be a couple of other target clients reporting entities in mind, but by and large, FINTRAC is looking to provide institutions that deal in international money movements with this kind of guidance.
When we look at this report, what did we really learn about the state of terrorism financing in Canada?
Well, it depends on what you already knew. So if you don't know anything about terrorist financing and you read this report, you actually learn quite a lot about how a number of groups raise money around the world and how their jurisdictions or countries are used by those groups to do that. If you already know a lot about terrorist financing, there's really nothing new in this report. There is very little mention of actual Canadian connections here, with a couple of notable exceptions that I did want to bring up because they're kind of ridiculous in a lot of ways. So the first one is they talk about charities receiving funds on behalf of terrorist organizations. And they talk about that in Canada, charities and nonprofit organizations. And they say it with a lot of certainty. So this is something that you and I will know from our work in the national security field, that certainty is something that's very much frowned upon.
Right.
Like, we used to be coached to say things like,
possibly, suspect,
could, right, may, very likely. You know, a lot of terms that are not sure. What FINTRAC actually says here is that Hezbollah is operating in Canada, operating nonprofit organizations or charitable organizations, and that's happening.
Right.
So they say, and there's no caveat around that.
Right.
It's a fact.
Hezbollah is financing in Canada.
Right. And the thing that I think is so interesting about that is that, you know, certainly the lack of any sort of caveat around that language, but then when you look at what sort of law enforcement has done about Hezbollah financing in Canada, which is, from a public perspective, absolutely nothing.
Right.
There have been no arrests, no prosecutions, and no listings of any entity associated with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is, of course, a listed terrorist entity, but like any of the organizations could also become listed, and that has not happened.
Right. And there's no real explanation for that. They say, okay, well, this terrorism financing is happening in Canada, and then
that's all
blank.
They say. That's all they say.
And that's interesting because if you look at the other reports, they talk about all the different things that they're doing. And by the other reports, I mean the public report and the terrorist threat. But we don't see any arrests on this front.
Right.
Why is that?
Oh, yeah. That's a whole can of worms. So the first thing is FINTRAC will talk about what it's doing in its annual report.
Right.
But this document is very much that guidance to reporting entities.
Right.
So they don't want to get into adding in all of that kind of additional information. They want it to be very targeted so that banks and money services businesses can use this information in their data holdings. Why there are no terrorist arrests or prosecutions in Canada, or very few, honestly, I think that's a podcast for another time.
Right.
We actually did cover it before.
We will happily have you on again. But,
I have answers.
Right. But that's actually what's really interesting is, like, because you and I, you know, when we worked in the space, one of the key things that we worked on was this idea of indicators. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's all the indicators that they've put in. So I was wondering, having worked on this, in some cases together, what was your take on the indicator approach in this report?
Yeah, the indicator approach is interesting. And this is a bit of a difficulty that FinTrack faces, and actually all financial intelligence units around the world face. They're generating indicators based off of a certain amount of reporting that they're getting from their reporting entities, and maybe some classified or open source reporting. But the indicators that they're creating, or what they're seeing, is really based on their data. So the challenge now becomes for banks and money service businesses and other reporting entities to translate that activity into rules that they can then apply to their data holdings, and in some cases, big data holdings. So the way FinTrack has presented it, they've talked about some of these jurisdictions and indicators related to these jurisdictions. But frankly, if you were to apply, you know, a rule to a bank's information holding saying that Lebanon is a jurisdiction of concern, so we need to pay closer attention to all transactions coming and going from Lebanon, that doesn't solve your problem in any way. It just gives you a huge haystack in which to look for that needle. Now you can start to apply other rules to that as well, and you start to get a little bit closer to it. But, you know, fundamentally, the problem is that these are very broad, unspecific indicators that need to be applied to a big data set. And I'm not really convinced that it's actually going to help the banks do a lot of that work.
Now, is this the advice that FinTrack has been giving to financial institutions all along that just hasn't been made public, or is FinTrack actually providing more granular advice?
Oh, it's definitely more granular. I don't think that I've ever seen them provide anything that's so jurisdictionally focused and so terrorist organization focused.
Right.
Two really big differences. Before, a lot of the information that they've been providing in the trends and typologies reports are very just that, trends and typologies, very general, very vague.
Who is this really aimed at? Simply because, like you said, this seems to be a report that's intended for public and public consumption, but the way the evidence is actually presented is like it was cut and pasted from advice that you would give to a financial institution.
Yeah, I think it's actually maybe trying to do two things.
Right.
So the first one, of course, being that sort of information for reporting entities. The other one is to fit into what seems to be the government's broader approach in terms of public engagement in the national security space. So we saw it with the CSIS Indicators of Mobilization of Violence report. We've seen it with, I think it was the Cyber Center report that you were talking about last week, and
right,
a couple of other things.
It felt like too technical for the public, but maybe not granular enough for financial institutions. I guess that's where I left it. And that's when I was kind of tweeting about it the other day, I said, well, geez, I can't wait for Jess to walk me through this because I really don't know what the story is here.
Well, the thing about financial institutions that I've really come to learn over the last year is that they want the exceptionally tactical information. That's what they think is useful. So the names and those
right,
kinds of details. In the absence of that, they find high-level trends and typologies reports and even potentially even this report to be just really something that creates a lot of work for them. Now, I'm not particularly sympathetic to that perspective because I think that I know that they have a responsibility to be looking for terrorist financing. And the interesting thing about that is, too, in Canada, we do tend to have a bit of a culture of the banks wanting to appear to be complying, but without having to spend any real money in the compliance space. So without wanting to spend any real money developing really effective monitoring tools to detect terrorist financing. But that's not true around the world. There are many other jurisdictions or countries that have financial institutions that spend a lot of money on compliance and rival financial intelligence unit outputs.
Right.
So they can produce reports on how ISIL fighters are financing themselves based on their own data that would rival anything that we've seen.
Banks here aren't really as sophisticated as you think they could be.
They're certainly sophisticated. I don't think that they're willing to spend the money to effectively tackle the problem.
Huh. So let me ask you something a little bit different, because one of the things I noticed about this particular report was that
there was no future technology. We've seen a lot that's been reported about how terrorists are using cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and things like this, which I think is probably overstated a bit. But do you think this is something that should have been more included in the report?
This was the best part about the report.
Okay.
The fact that in no way, nowhere does it say Bitcoin in this report, which was a breath of fresh air in the terrorist financing space.
Right.
There is nothing, in my view, more overblown than terrorist use of Bitcoin. Cryptocurrency, more broadly, I would say is more used than Bitcoin. But FinTrack does actually talk about alternative payment methods and systems.
Okay.
So that sort of encompasses sort of that financial technology, new payment methods, all of these different things that are up and coming. And I think it's actually well balanced in terms of what we see realistically from terrorist financing. Terrorist financing is done through banks, through cash, through remittance companies. Very little of it is actually done through cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, yeah.
So terrorists, they may be creative, but they aren't particularly innovative.
I think it's really, there are individuals who will use the new technologies kind of as like a proof of concept to a certain extent, and some terrorist organizations will use it. But, you know, when you're talking broad strokes about all the terrorist organizations in the world, their use of Bitcoin and new payment methods and stuff is reflective of how FinTrack has sort of put it in this report. You know, every terrorist organization is different, so it's hard to make those kind of gross generalizations, but this is properly balanced.
Is there anything that you want to add, or is there anything you would like to see in future reports that FinTrack puts out?
Well, this is really interesting, because FinTrack has actually promised in this report to be doing other things, like operational briefs and operational alerts, including monitoring and reporting of more geographic-specific information in the future. And so what I think that that may mean is we may see some more detailed jurisdiction or country-specific reports,
right,
talking in more detail about how things are happening in those countries. The thing that's really interesting about what FinTrack is doing is they're really doing the work of some of the reporting entities. This is the kind of work that compliance shops should be doing for themselves.
Right.
FinTrack has taken it upon themselves to provide this kind of information to them free of charge as part of their public service. And I think that it's really up to banks, money services, businesses, and other reporting entities to make the most of this information.
When you say compliance offices, you mean the compliance offices within banks to ensure that they're following the law to prevent or to adhere to Canada's international obligations with regards to money laundering and terrorist finance.
Yeah, and so that's the base. That's the base level of compliance, in my view, and I think in the view of many other people who work in the space. Compliance shops need to be going well beyond the bare minimum of compliance and being much more proactive in terms of identifying terrorist financing. And this is what this report is intended to help them do.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
It's my pleasure.
So, I mean, it was a really great opportunity to speak with Jess because, as I said in the interview, it wasn't clear to me who this report was for or why. It seemed to be too technical for the public, but it seemed to be not technical enough for someone who might actually use it. But it did give a very good understanding of the areas of concern. It's funny because, again, Canada doesn't often name countries. But, you know, here we are saying, oh, Lebanon's got a lot of problematic systems and things like that. So that was really interesting to see. But one of the things I felt was that in one of the reports we talked about last week, the cyber threat assessment, it came with a vocabulary list, right? It came with a list of terms that are being used. I really think in the future that I would like to see FinTrack do that next year, if they could come out with a list of terms so that people could actually understand what these terms are and what they mean for the purpose of someone like me who understands, you know, terrorism but doesn't necessarily understand all the monies.
Great. Well, that's all the time we have today. This has been a long podcast, but we're assuming that people have lots of time over the holiday break to listen to us natter on. We're going to have one more episode just in advance of Christmas, so the 25th. And the reason that we mentioned Christmas specifically is because it'll be a Christmas special. Until then, enjoy the beginnings of your holiday.
Happy holidays.